For those of you who don't know who Roger and Nancy are, let me just give them a quick introduction. Dr. Roger Morrison grew up in Tennessee and attended medical school there, graduating in 1978. In 1978, while still in medical training, Dr. Morrison attended his very first seminar in homeopathy, and that occurred in Athens. And it was at that seminar that he decided to study at the Athenian Center for Homeopathic Medicine, which at the time was one of the foremost centers for homeopathy in the world. It was a center that was created and run by the well-known homeopath George Vitulkis. Dr. Morrison spent 4 years learning to speak Greek and then completed a 2-year fellowship at the center in Athens. During his stay, Dr. Morrison became one of the top assistants at the center, eventually earning the prestigious diploma of the Athenian Center. Upon completion of his fellowship in 1984, Dr. Morrison returned to the United States to assist in the establishment of the Hahnemann Medical Clinic and the Hahnemann Medical College of Homeopathy. He divides his time between his practice at the clinic, teaching at the college, and other institutions and writing. Dr. Morrison lectures throughout the world on many aspects of homeopathy. He's also published 20 articles, at least, in homeopathic journals throughout the world since 1984. He's also presented papers before the International League of Homeopathy. In 1993, Dr. Morrison completed his work on his first textbook, which is called The Desktop Guide. It's one of the best-selling books in homeopathy. It's become a standard text. And in 1999, he published his second text called The Desktop Companion. Also, more recently, he's published a work specifically devoted to the carbon remedies. And he's also involved right now in a video course and book on miasms, and also a video course on the first 18 months of their 4-year program. Perhaps they can give us a little bit more information about that a little bit later on. We also have our other guest, Dr. Morrison's wife, Nancy Herrick, who's a physician's assistant, and she was one of the members of the very now historic Bay Area Homeopathic Study Group. She had her first job in healthcare at the Bay Area Women's Health Collective at the Herring Family Health Clinic in 1974. Ms. Herrick began her 27 years practice as a homeopath. In 1985, she was one of the driving forces behind the creation of the Hahnemann Medical College Clinic and the Hahnemann College of Homeopathy. Her main homeopathic teachers have been George Vitulkis and Rajan Sankaran. Ms. Herrick is a widely respected homeopath and homeopathic educator. She began her extensive career as a lecturer in 1983 with the International Foundation for Homeopathy. Since that time, she's lectured throughout Europe, America, Australia, New Zealand, and India, and she has been published widely both in the United States and abroad. For a period of 5 years, Ms. Herrick was extensively involved in research developing new homeopathic medications, including lacequinum and lactofenum, as well as 15 other remedies. These were all published as part of an 8-remedy study in a book titled Animal Mind, Human Voices. After that book specifically focusing on animal provings, she published a new book on plants called Sacred Plants, Human Voices, which was a work which focused on many plant remedies, including lotus, ginseng, peyote, ayahuasca, mandragora, and rose. So again, thank you both of you for joining us. You have we have a lot to talk about this evening, and we really appreciate it. Now, Roger and Nancy are going to be speakers at this year's upcoming LIGA conference, which will be occurring in Redondo Beach between May 18th and May 22nd, and they're going to be specifically talking about the carbon remedies. So I thought perhaps I could just start by asking, how did you become interested specifically in carbon remedies?
Well, thanks, Kim, for the nice introduction. We were teaching the Hahnemann course for about 20 years, and by the way, we're no longer teaching the Hahnemann course. Maybe I hadn't filled you in on that.
Okay, thanks for letting us know.
Yeah. Yeah, we after 20 years, we decided we were too old to keep it up anymore. So here we're just teaching independently and you know, seminars rather than a full-time school. But while we were teaching that school, every year that we taught it, we changed the schedule of the course. And in the final 2 runs of the course, we decided to go from teaching alphabetically, like we'd always done, polycrests, and then we would teach the smaller remedies, starting with, you know, ABs and going through to Zingerberg, more or less alphabetically. And we decided at that time to shift to a more sort of systems-based or topic-based way of presenting the remedies. So in that, we started teaching all of the Kali remedies together or all of the natrums together. And then we taught all the plants in the same way by plant families, like the ranunculus families and so forth. Or then we taught all the snakes, Naya and Lachesis and Elaps all together. And at the end of the first time that we did this, just as a double check, I went through towards the end of the course and checked off every remedy that we had previously taught against the ones that we had already taught in the course in this new systems-based way of teaching. And as I checked them off, I found that we had left out about 15 important remedies, and of those, most of them were the carbon remedies. Graphites, petroleum, glenoinum, carbovegetabilis, carboanimalis, creosote, camphor, so forth. So there were about 15 remedies that we just hadn't taught. And so I said, well, let me teach all this as a group, and we'll get those all out of the way, and then we'll have done all of our traditional remedies. And then I thought, well, as long as I'm going to teach this as a group, let me just sit and study it a little bit and see, is there any similarity between these, you know, very different remedies, chemically different remedies? Is there some set of rubrics or themes that seems to go through the whole group? And so the first thing I did was just put these remedies onto one of the computer programs. I can't remember if it was Radar or Reference Works or which one. And I put all the remedies that I was going to be studying, and then I just tried to see which rubrics were in common. And the first thing that jumped out was the rubric confusion of mind loses his way in well-known streets. And the two strongest remedies for this are petroleum and glenoinum, which are both in the carbon group of remedies. And I thought, wow, maybe there's a theme here. So I started to study going back to my own cured cases and borrowing Nancy's cases and cases of my other colleagues, Bill Gray and Jonathan Shore, in the Hahnemann course. I started going through each of these cases, and what I found was a tremendous similarity in all of these carbon cases. And one of the strongest characteristics had to do with this confusion of mind. And when you think about it, in retrospect, I'm not. I don't know why I was so surprised, because really, the what do we do with carbon remedies like alcohol, or think of all the kids sniffing glue to get high, or carbon tetrachloride, and the myriad of carbon-based remedies, substances that we come in contact with in our environment. All of them are known intoxicants and create confusion of mind and mental blurriness. So I don't know why I was so surprised to find this correlation, but it just struck me. And then I continued studying from there through the cases and through the provings and the repertory, and found many other similarities. So that's how the whole thing started.
Very interesting.
It was just a coincidence.
Yeah, it's amazing how things like that happen in life, you know, that exactly when you need to discover something, it comes into your, you know, into your awareness or consciousness. You know, I'm just, in terms of delineating which remedies are the carbon remedies and which ones aren't, could you just, I mean, you mentioned a few, but could you give us the complete list of those which you would group as the carbons? And, I mean, I would assume you put Adamas in there as well as one of
sure.
the... But also, I'm just curious in terms of, because every plant and so many things in nature have carbon in them, how do you make a demarcation point between those which you consider carbon remedies and...
Right. That's an excellent question, Kim. And that very thing perplexed me for a long time. And what I finally ended up doing, because in essence, every plant and every animal is composed mainly of carbon. So you could say, you know, almost all of the remedies are carbon-based, but then you're missing the sort of the gist of what the true carbon remedies are. And think of it this way. Many substances affect us through, for example, plants affect us through the various alkaloids that they have inside of them. Now, those alkaloids affect various receptor sites in the body, and mostly their effect on the human system is through these larger chemicals which act through receptor sites that mimic various natural hormones or endocrine glands or morphine receptor sites or things like that. So they affect us in a much different way than simple carbon compounds which pass directly into our bloodstream and through our blood-brain barrier and affect us not through any receptor sites but just through toxicologic effects. So I eliminated all the plants and animals and anything that was a complex molecule that could affect the system through other systems in the body rather than simply pure toxicology of carbon.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And
now, the complete list is huge. It's like 150 remedies.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, I don't think we should probably try and go through every one, but you know, maybe if I just name the most common ones.
Okay.
Would that be...
Yeah, that would be great.
So I'm going to do this alphabetically because that's the kind of guy I am. Start out with...
To me.
Acetic acid.
Okay.
Adamus, which is diamond. Ether. Alcohol. Alcoholis, which is... You know, it was recently, not that recent, recently proved by Paul Hirschu.
Right.
But we had lots of information about this remedy for a long time, and hardly anybody used it. But I just want to recommend it to the listeners as a really very common remedy in our practice nowadays. Amyl nitrate. Benzoic acid. Butyric acid, camphor, carboanamalis, carbovegetabilis, those are really common ones, carbolic acid, and we have the carbonium remedies, the most common of which is carbonium sulfuratum, then planoinum, graphites, hydrocyanic acid, creosotum, lactic acid. I'm leaving out some of the smaller ones. Oxalic acid, of course, is quite well known. Picric acid, petroleum, Pix liquid, sacrum album, and the other sugar remedies like sacrum lactis or Nell. Succinic acid, tannic acid, terebinthina, uric acid. I think I left out gallic acid, which I would consider a fairly common remedy. So those would be the ones that are famous enough that everybody would have heard of.
Yeah, or have some familiarity with. Now you. Roger, you had mentioned that one of the common characteristics that you discovered with these carbon remedies is this confusion of the mind. Were there other common characteristics that you found that ran across these carbon remedies?
Yes. So maybe I could just go through those because I think that's really one of the hearts of my work, and I think it would make it much easier for your listeners to identify when they need to be thinking of a carbon-based remedy for their patients. So maybe I could go through this in a little bit of detail. If
that sounds
okay.
Great.
Okay. So let's start out talking about the confusion, because there's a few very characteristic things in the confusion of the carbon remedies. Confusion, of course, being a rather general thing, and not that many plant remedies like Helebris or Baptisia are confused, and many other mineral remedies and so forth. But there's some specific things about the carbon confusion. So the first, which I alluded to, was the sensation of being lost in well-known places. And it's a sense of complete disorientation, and maybe I'll just read a few quotes from the literature just to illustrate this. So, for example, the remedy camphor bromatum, which is a camphor derivative, one of the people, he's a prover, said, "My first impression was that I had boarded the wrong train. I was completely turned around and could not disabuse myself of the idea that the train was going south instead of north." And then, of course, we know about petroleum and glenoinum and many other carbon-based remedies that get lost. But, for example, here's from the proving of Sacrum Lactis. "Loses her way in well-known streets, gets completely bewildered, walked from 5th Avenue to 10th Avenue while intending to go to 2nd Avenue, wondered how the avenues had gotten on the wrong side of the city." Or in succinic acid, "I feel totally lost and cannot relate to where I am. Suddenly I find I'm in a laneway and I don't recognize the street." So that's a very key characteristic, is the sense of being disoriented, getting completely twisted around in your location. The second thing is, I use the word vacant to describe it. And, in the vernacular of American teenagers, our daughter taught us this phrase, nobody's home. So it's a kind of look about the face and the eyes, but also the patient themselves will complain of a feeling of being just completely vacant, where they sit and stare for several minutes before they catch themselves just staring, and they go, "Wow, where was I?" Many times our patients have this kind of it's kind of far away, and at the same time, it's as if there's not enough thoughts going through the head. Many of our remedies are known for having too many thoughts in their head, like coffee or China or whatnot. Many of our remedies can have too few thoughts going through their head. And I remember George Vithulkis talking about this in relationship to the remedy Graphites, which is pure carbon. And then I started to see that this was the case of many other of the carbon remedies. So there's this kind of vacancy in the mind. And then just a general mental weakness. And where we see that the most commonly is in slowness of answering. So many times the patient, you'll ask a question, and there's a significant delay before they can just put their thoughts together enough to come up with an answer. Now, this is in, the more extreme cases, but it's quite common. And another problem will be with, specifically for the carbons, is with reading. I would say most of the cases that need a carbon-based remedy will admit to some difficulty with reading. They just can't focus on reading. They read one line and then they realize they didn't comprehend it. They have to go back and study it again. So this kind of thing is very, very common.
Very interesting. And now, what about in terms of physical symptoms, Roger? Are there any common denominators there? I mean, you've been talking about some of the confusion and the weakness of the mind and things like that, but what about on a physical level?
Well, that's very interesting. Yes, there's some very strong characteristics in the physicals as well. There's a few other things with mentals, but we can come back to those.
Oh, if I cut you off, please finish the mentals and then go on, move on to the physicals.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now you've got me running in circles here, but
my fault.
I'll tell just a couple of others, because there are some there are some ones that are pretty strong. One is sort of a longing for the past. And I don't know how to put that too clearly, except that sometimes they'll mention homesickness. For example, you'll see rubric under the rubric homesickness, you'll see carboanamalis, glenoinum, petroleum, sacromalbum, and so forth. You'll see the rubric for homesickness. But it's not just the home. It's kind of longing back for a time when they were more clear or more focused in the now, in reality. Whereas when you can imagine when your mind is not concentrated, when you're lost, there's a feeling of isolation, which is another big theme with the carbon remedies. Just a feeling like you can't make contact with people well. And in fact, you can't make contact when your mind is not operating at the same speed that everybody else's is. So I would say those are three of the big characteristics in the mind. And then there's a few other things that are worth mentioning.
Well, one thing actually I was going to say is this sensation of sinking. It's actually something that they talk about a lot, and almost all the cases I've had of carbon actually have used this gesture where their hands kind of come above their head and they just bring their hands down, and it's like a sensation of, they describe it as, I feel like I'm draining, or just everything is draining out of me. I'm like sinking down, or it can even be a feeling of falling, or impulses to jump, or just this feeling that their vitality, everything is weak and draining out of them.
Downward seems to be one of the big motions for the carbon remedies, just the sense of things going down. And it's often related to both the vitality and the emotions, as well as a physical sensation. It's a whole complex.
And it's associated also with mental weakness, where there's just this difficulty answering, or the speech is very slow, or they have very poor or weak memory, they can't concentrate, and then they just make mistakes, mistakes in writing, speaking, and difficulty reading.
And then just a couple of other points. One is ghosts seem to come up for many of these cases, ghosts or spirits, things like that. They can see ghosts, they can have fear of ghosts, that kind of thing. So that would be strong. And then another would be a sense of shock. These remedies seem to be very susceptible to shock in general, emotional shock and physical shock, not just carbovegetabilis, which is, of course, our most famous remedy for shock, but many of the other remedies as well. So getting back to the physical characteristics, there's many that are quite common. Nancy talked about the weakness in general and just the general sense of lack of vitality. And that's often associated with a feeling of faintness or fainting. There's a condition that we see quite a lot of as homeopaths, which is sometimes it's called chemical sensitivity syndrome or environmental sensitivity or something like that. I didn't particularly used to believe in this. I thought people were just kind of nuts that were having this when I first came back to this country from my studies in Greece. And then I started seeing more and more cases. These are people who, every time they walk into a room where somebody's wearing perfume, or if they go into the detergent section of the grocery store, or if they walk into an office and somebody is changing the toner in their printer or something like that, and they get exposed to even very tiny amounts of carbon-based chemicals, they feel horrible. They get mentally confused. They get disoriented. They feel faint and weak. They get sort of an intoxicated sensation. They can't think clearly. basically all the symptoms that I discovered were common for carbon remedies. Now, this particular syndrome, I'm going to say probably half of the patients that really have this syndrome need a remedy from the carbon group. So that can be a huge tip-off that you're looking at a carbon remedy. And then just a few other specific symptoms, which is the sensitivity to both heat and cold. We usually think of, for example, mercury or natrum carbonicum for this symptom. But in my experience, almost every single case that requires a carbon remedy has great sensitivity to both heat and cold, and often specifically to the sun. Of course, very famous for that is glenoinum, but many of the other remedies like camphor, which has the great sensitivity to heat and cold at the same time, where even though they feel tremendous cold, they can't stand any heat at the same time. So, and carbovegetables have similar symptoms where they need to be fanned despite the fact that they're very chilly, so, and can't stand heat, and are great remedies for sunstroke in general. So this sensitivity to heat and cold, and sometimes with a kind of a searing sensation of heat at the very vertex of the head, and we'll see that in many of the carbon remedies. And then in food cravings, there's usually either a craving or an aversion to both carbohydrates and sweets, which makes sense since those are both carbon substances, and especially to alcohol, tremendous sensitivity to alcohol. Just one drop of, you know, they say, take a sip of wine and I feel intoxicated. That kind of patient often will need a carbon-based remedy. And one other peculiar food craving, which is to do with smoked flavor. Many of the patients will crave smoke or smoke-flavored foods. Sometimes the patients will tell us, you know, many patients are very sensitive to petrochemical fumes from cars or things like that. On the other hand, many will tell us that they crave that, like they love to smell the smell of somebody having their roof tarred in their neighborhood, or they love cigarette smoke, or they love to be around a wood fire, whereas, you know, on the opposite side, many people will be extraordinarily sensitive to any kind of smoke in their environment. So they may either crave it or be hypersensitive to it. So those would be some of the most common physical and mental characteristics of the carbon remedies.
Very interesting. So Nancy and Roger, for both of you, I'm curious, how frequently do you actually, I know you both have very busy practices, what percentage of your practice are you finding that you're actually giving carbon remedies? I mean, is this something you're giving on a weekly basis, monthly? Is this, you know, how common do you find these in your actual practice?
Well, one thing I'd have to say is that it's some of our sickest patients needing these remedies. So in that, it's been a real benefit. But in terms of percentage, I don't know, what would you say, Roger?
No, it's not a huge percentage, maybe one case in 100 or two cases in 100 that need these remedies. What's interesting is that most of these are cases that you don't spot it on the first prescription. So it'll be somebody who's been really sick through many remedies and gotten nowhere. And then finally, you'll grab the idea, maybe this patient needs a carbon remedy. And then you can hone in on which specific remedy to try and pick the perfect one for that particular case. So not a gigantic group, less than, say, sulfur. All cases of the carbon remedies are probably less frequent than sulfur in your practice, that one single remedy, but still it's...
So it's most significant in that it treats these really mysterious, very difficult to cure cases, you know, especially, like Roger was saying, the EI cases.
Sure. So I'm curious, you know, you've shared with us some very interesting ideas and themes that run across these carbon remedies. And but still, you know, I could think of other remedies that would also fit with many of those different ideas. So my question is, how do you differentiate when you really need a carbon remedy relative to perhaps a remedy from another, you know, because, like, for example, you talk about sinking sensation. Well, you see that in digitalis, or the homesickness you see in capsicum, or, you know, there's other themes we find in other remedies. How will you know specifically that we need a carbon remedy?
So what I would say is if you're really asking for the core secret of the carbons, it's going to come to you from one of three ways. One is a case that comes in with utter depletion, like carboveg tablets. The next is when somebody comes in with great confusion. And the third is when they come in with this environmental sensitivity syndrome.
Mm.
Now, you're not going to pick it just based on that. You're going to see that as sort of the beginning before you start to think about the carbons. Then you have to see the other these other properties, the sense of being isolated in the world, the fear of ghosts, the sensitivity to heat and cold. You have to see all of those characteristics in the same patient before you'll have the courage to prescribe one of the carbon remedies.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, many of them may have had family history. For example, in the remedy alcoholis, mm-hmm. which, as I mentioned, is a fairly common remedy for us now. You won't see so many alcoholics who come in and need this remedy, but almost every one of them have very, very strong history of alcoholism in the family. Similar with, for example, sacramalbum, which is one of the other large remedies in the group. You won't necessarily see diabetes in the patient, but very frequently there'll be a history of diabetes somewhere in the family. So sometimes the family history can really push you in the right direction.
Yeah, Roger, those three primary features that you mentioned, do you find that they all have to be there for you to prescribe a carbon remedy, or one or a couple of them have to be there? Or?
No, any one of those three is enough to make you think about carbon.
Okay.
Then you want to try and use these other characteristics, and of course, the repertory in all of your resources in choosing the remedy. Yeah.
Great. Any other pointers in terms of being able to differentiate these from other remedies in practice?
Well, one thing Roger hasn't told you, but there is he breaks down this 150 remedies into many other groups that make it much easier to figure out which of these remedies, because many of these remedies haven't got good provings, and they're not very well known. So it's really hard to differentiate some of them. So I don't know if you want...
I think that might be too much detail for today's talk, but
You're going to be talking about this at Liga anyway, isn't that right? I mean, some of these...
We will be speaking about this at the Liga.
Yeah, okay.
And, of course, there's articles about the carbons in various places and the book.
Actually, tell us a little bit about the book so the people who are listening can find out a little bit more about it.
Okay, well, the book is called Carbon, Organic and Hydrocarbon Remedies in Homeopathy. And this is the result of about 5 or 6 years of pretty much steady work going through all the cases that I could accumulate through the literature and through my own practice and the practice of all of my close colleagues, that I was able to extract sort of the core themes and physicals. So the first part of the book just talks about the general characteristics of the carbon remedies. What we did in very brief this afternoon, I spend, dozens of pages describing each of these themes. And then I go through each of the known homeopathic carbon remedies and give, everything from the history of the use of the chemical, its chemical structures and properties. Then I go through everything that's known about the homeopathic picture of the remedy, and then I give any cases that I was able to find either of my own or in the literature, so that you can get the best possible feeling for the remedy, so that you can sort of, once you decide that you need a carbon remedy, there's a way of getting to which remedy is going to be the best one for that patient. So that's sort of the core of the book. And then I summarize my discoveries about these various subgroups within the carbon groups, for example, the amines or the aromatic group and so forth. But I think it's too much to go into those details now. But that's all in the book as well.
Great.
Yeah.
Nancy, I know that the subject really here was carbons, but you'd mentioned provings, and I know you've done some excellent work on provings. So I thought, could you just tell us a little bit about the two books that you've written on provings, and maybe you could share a little bit about some of your interesting experiences. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about Lotus, for example, which I thought was a very interesting outcome in terms of the proving, or whatever you'd like to share about, actually.
Yes. Well, okay. So actually, I worked on each of those proving books. It was more like, 5 years of research and then a couple years of writing each of those books. So it was really, kind of one of my main lifetime experiences as a homeopath was doing 18 provings. Basically, I used the students in our course, and it was we did a proving almost every year for the last 10 years. And what we would do is there would be a group of provers and then a group of people who would help each one of the provers, take down information, and they would take the remedy at actually a maximum of 3 times. So they didn't take the remedy very much. And if they had any symptoms at all, they didn't continue taking it. They would just take it once. And then they would write for a month. They would write down all their physical symptoms and their mental symptoms in a journal. And they would also write, in great detail, dreams and anything that happened to them during this period of time. So we had these journals, we collected these journals, and we also did video interviews of the entire group when they came back to class. And this would be the culmination of the proving. And what we discovered was just, it was really stunning for me. I even though I'd been a homeopath for many years at this point, by the way, it's more like 34 years now.
Oh, sorry about that. I try to make you younger.
It just keeps growing. And my first proving was lion's milk, right. And I was stunned because people came back with dreams of cats and all kinds of direct sensations of, like pet, like licking their fur, dreams of licking their fur, and dreams of cats and dreams of lions. And so I realized that, this basis that we have.
Of course, none of the provers knew what they were taking.
Right.
But these were all double-blind studies.
Yes.
Okay. Single-blind, I would say.
Well, I knew what they were, but none of the provers knew what they were, or their proving guides. They didn't know what they
right.
were. So I was the only one who
did
knew.
Did you guys use placebo as well, or no placebo?
I did not. I decided not to use placebo because I felt like each prover was giving us such huge amount of information.
Mm.
It was so valuable that that I just didn't want to use a placebo.
Sure.
I didn't want to, waste the opportunity.
Right.
Because it was such a job for someone to do this. So I realized to the depth of my understanding that provings were powerful experiences. Now, the Lotus was actually, it was interesting you ask about that one, because it was the most extreme, I would say extreme is the right word.
That's why I asked about it, because I remember reading the proving and
yes. So in Lotus, I had, I can't remember now, it was, I think 4 of the provers actually became suicidal or homicidal. And I, you know, of course we have expectations. You know, we have expectations what approving might be like. And knowing that lotus is considered, you know, a kind of very sacred plant that the Buddhists depict in their artwork, and, you know, the Buddhas are always sitting on a lotus flower. And so I had these images that it was going to be this very spiritual, you know, elevated proving. But the truth is that lotus has both ends of the spectrum. Lotus has the root that goes down into the mud and the muck at the bottom of the lake or the pond, and that it thrives on that muck. I mean, that's the roots down at the bottom. And then it comes up, and as it comes up through the water, it, you know, at the very top, it actually leaves the water. So the blossom is above the water, and any insect or dirt or bug or anything that comes onto the blossom is washed away with a kind of, it's almost like a silicone-like
repellent
on the top of the flower that actually just, things just slide right off of it. So it's an amazing plant that was exactly expressed in the proving. So the root, you know, the deepest, darkest states can be in lotus, as well as the most elevated spiritual, you know, like complete state of truth and enlightenment are expressed by lotus. And the other thing that came out really strongly was dizziness. A real strong vertigo, the most severe kinds of vertigo can be treated with lotus. So that came out very strongly in the proving, and we've had cases since then that have been cured with, you know, who had such severe vertigo that they couldn't function. They had to go on disability and just basically stay at home and lay in bed. So it was. It was a very powerful experience. And, of course, as a proving master dealing with these cases that became so disabled from the proving was quite an experience in itself.
Are you planning to do more provings, Nancy? Or
no, I think I'm not. I'm actually done.
It's
I did 18.
Yeah.
Although one of Nancy's unpublished provings was one that it was the one that was done in a total double blind fashion, and this was the late Michael Quinn snuck in the remedy carbon dioxide into her
animals and plants group.
Really?
Yeah, I said, Michael, you pick the remedy this time and don't tell me what it is.
She gave him a bunch of choices, but he chose, instead of to give the ones that she wanted, he wanted to find out about carbon dioxide. So we slipped that into the group, and so we had a proving of carbon dioxide, which I published in its entirety in my book on the carbon remedies, and have also used it successfully in two cases so far. So it's I think it's a very interesting remedy and fit exactly the themes that we'd found for the other carbon remedies.
Interesting. Any plans to publish that one?
It's in the book, but I don't.
It's in your carbon book.
It's in the carbon book, right? There was no other place to publish.
I got you.
Yeah.
Okay. It was a small proving, and so I don't think it. But yeah, if somebody else wanted to pick it up and, you know, run it in one of the journals or something, I'd be happy for that to happen.
Fantastic. So I'd like to open it up and let some other people ask questions, but before I do that, I know that you've got a video course and a book on miasms. I thought perhaps you could share a little bit about that and also a little bit about the video course of the first 18 months of your four-year course. Could you just share with about those two things?
Well, yeah, we have a course on the miasms that we've just completed. Basically, it's Rajan Sankaran's system of miasms, so there's 9 miasms, and we go through them in great detail using cases, and we've got a system we've We haven't been comfortable showing our cases on videos because, you know, we don't want to reveal such intimacy. We do it in our seminars, but with the patients. So we've come up with a system where we actually block out the patient's face, but you can see their patient's gestures and you can see, you know, you hear their words. And so it's quite effective as a video series. And we really go into great detail on each of the nine miasms. And we've found in our practice that this is absolutely one of the most beneficial things we've ever learned. The miasms really help you find the remedy. Breaks it down, you know, into nine different categories, which each category has a very, very distinct and particular set of symptoms and characteristics. So we're very proud of our miasm series. It's one of the best things we've ever done.
And we're now working, we're taking the actual cases in our actual lectures and turning that into a book to be a companion to the DVD series, which is available through Rudra Press. It's rudrapress.com, all one word, RudraPress.com. And the people at Rudra Press have very kindly taken over the whole production of the DVDs, and they're also they did the same thing for the Hahnemann College course. In the first 18 months, we cover all of the polycrests and most of the basic theory and repertory study, things like that, philosophy, history, as well as the, you know, acute cases, how to take acute cases, and then going through all the differentials for pneumonia and earaches and so forth and so on. So all of that's in the Hahnemann College course. And Rudra Press has done the production on that, the editing, cleaned up all of our very erratic videos and turned it into something useful. So we're very thankful for Rudra Press for doing that.
So they're all
pretty. URL one more time so people can get it.
Rudra, yep, Rudra, R-U-D-R-A Press, P-R-E-S-S.com.
Great.
And then when you go to the page, it has something like subjects, and then you tap on that, and then you go down to the homeopathy section, and then you can find the whole DVD series there.
Great. Are any other lectures, teaching tours, anything that you're doing you'd like to share with the participants?
Well, let's see. We're headed off to Europe right now, and we'll be giving seminars in May in Munich and then in Prague. And then we're giving one seminar here in California in October.
I was just going to look up the dates.
Yeah.
And also we should tell you about our how to order our books, if anyone is interested in ordering Carbon or Animal Minds or...
go ahead and share that.
You can either write to us. Our email address for our shipping department is Jaffe Marks, JaffeMarks at yahoo.com. Or you can write to us. Let me give you, where's our address? Yeah. It's Hahnemann Clinic Publishing. And it's at 13974. Glen Pines Road, G-L-E-N-N, Pines Road, Grass Valley, California, 95945.
And the seminar we're giving is, we're going to be doing a seminar on animals, plants, and minerals, one day of each, and a half day we're actually going to be giving us, we'll be doing elephant, and some information on nutrition, which we're also very involved in, in California, at Corte Madera. And the seminar is going to be November 4th through November 7th.
Right. And if they want more information, where would they go to get that?
Hahnemann Clinic, Hahnemann, at...
No. Oh, you know what? The best place to do it is to write to our secretary, HMC, that's Hahnemann Medical Clinic, Richmond, at gmail.com.
Okay, good. And also, please, everybody, remember that both Roger and Nancy will be presenters at this year's upcoming LIGA 2010 conference in Redondo Beach, California. They'll be there along with many other well-known practitioners, including Franz Vermeulen, Will Taylor, Frederick Schroyens, Peter Fisher, Stephen Messer, Dr. Farouk Master, Andre Sain, and many other speakers. So it's really going to be an incredible assortment of the top homeopathic educators and practitioners from around the world. So let me go ahead and open it up to let some other people ask some questions. Does anybody have any questions for Roger Morrison and Nancy Herrick?
I have a question.
Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you all for coming together, Jim, for bringing us all together, and Roger and Nancy for taking time to do this. I've been very excited about learning more about the carbon since I listened to you about 3 years ago at the NCH conference. So I've been awaiting this book. My question is two, actually. I noticed that when you gave the list of common carbon remedies, you didn't mention some of the salts like Burita carbonica or Natrum carbonicum, and I wondered what where they lie in your research in terms of all the characteristics, and do you classify them with your carbon remedies? And the other question is specifically about diamond, and where one might find more information about the characteristics of this diamond remedy.
Okay, those are two great questions, and let me answer the second one first. Diamond, of course, is from the proving from Jeremy Scher, and so he has a book of provings, and you'll find his proving of Adamus, which is the Latin name for diamond, Adamus, A-D-A-M-A-S. And there was actually an earlier proving of diamond or Adamus by Rajan Sankaran's father, who was also a very famous homeopath of his time. So those two provings, would give you a lot to go from right there.
Roger, can I just add, there's also a video that Jeremy Scher made of Adamus as well that people can acquire.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And also I summarized the remedy in the book. Now, the second question about the salts of the carbon remedies, and there's many, many salts of various carbon remedies, not just the carbonates, which are related and have many of the same characteristics, but many of the acetates, for example, Burita acetica or Cuprum acetatum, and then salicylates like Natrum salicylicum or Cali salicylicum. So there's many salts of the carbon remedies. They're all related, but what you'll see with these salts is that they strike you first as related to the cation family. In other words, you'll think, "Wow, this looks like Natrum muriaticum," but there's a lot of things that don't fit for Natrum muriaticum. Then you start to think of the other salts of Natrums, and if you see a lot of the characteristics of the carbons, then you would think of possibly, for example, Natrum aceticum, Natrum carbonicum, Natrum salicylicum, or one of the other carbon-based salts of Natrum. So there's a lot of those. They're all listed in the book. One of the more common ones that people are many people already have cases of is califerrocyanatum. All of the cyanides are carbon-based remedies. So a lot of people have used califerrocyanatum just on the basis of, the well-known keynotes of like painless uterine hemorrhage. And when you see a case that it works beautifully on, if you go back and review it, you'll see many characteristics of carbon in most of those cases. I hope that answered the
Great.
Question.
Good question.
Yes, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, ask your question.
Are these remedies good for dementia, and what are the challenges?
I'm sorry, say that again. I think we didn't hear what your question. Say it one more time.
It might be for people with dementia, and what are the challenges of these taking in these
Did you hear that, Roger?
I think I got enough, which was the question, are these remedies useful in dementia? Yes, these are remedies that you can think of in dementia. In our typical dementia of old age, generally speaking, homeopathy only has palliative effect in most of those cases, unless you catch them real early. So treating Alzheimer's disease is extremely difficult, and for a variety of reasons, it's very difficult. First of all, because the pathology is so extreme. Even more importantly is because the patient cannot give the kind of intimate details about their symptoms because of the dementia, so it's very difficult to even take the case. Even with the family member there, you rarely get the specificity to come in, to hone in on a really deep constitutional remedy, just because the mental condition is so advanced. But if you can catch them early, then yes, some of these carbon remedies would be useful in some of those cases at the least.
Great. Other questions? Hi. We just have time for maybe one or two more questions. So
yes, hello?
Yes, please go ahead.
Hi. I have a question regarding the chemical sensitivity, and I'm wondering if you found if the trigger, say, a specific type of chemical, like a pesticide, might respond better to one of the carbon remedies than others?
Yes, that's a very good question. So most of the patients that come in with environmental sensitivity syndrome don't know what chemical they were originally exposed to. If, however, the patient does know a specific exposure that started off the whole thing, maybe they were exposed to formaldehyde, or maybe they were exposed to a pesticide or something, and you can find out what that pesticide was, you can try to give an isopathic remedy for that, and sometimes that will be effective. But what I would recommend first is try to identify the whole constitutional remedy that fits for them in, you know, for their whole case. And if you can spot a remedy that really fits their whole case, give that first. If it doesn't work, then you can take the more desperate step of trying to, you know, potentize the pesticide or whatever toxin that they were exposed to at the beginning. But as I say, most of the patients don't know a specific toxin that they were exposed to, or they were exposed to often many at the same time. They moved into a new house and were exposed to formaldehydes and pesticides and other solvents all at the same time, and it's impossible to choose a specific one from the history.
Right.
Yeah.
One last question.
Yeah, I have one question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my question might be very basic, but I wanted to know, like, these all remedies are very known remedies to us, and what are the basis to categorize these remedies in a carbon series? So I was just curious to know about it. Is it a chemical basis or a chemical salt? Yeah.
You know what? I didn't quite follow the question.
I think it's a similar question to what I asked, if I'm correct, which is what is the basis by which you group these remedies together?
Yeah, first of all, just based on the fact that they're formed primarily from carbon, so they're organic or carbon compounds chemically, and that's the group that I used to study.
Great.
So I see we're basically out of time. I want to remind everybody that Roger and Nancy will be both lecturing and the upcoming LIGA 2010 conference. You can get more information about that at www.LIGA2010.org. So www.LIGA2010.org. And they'll be lecturing there along with many other people. And you can also acquire Roger and Nancy's excellent books on carbon remedies, on keynotes of our remedies, an excellent book on therapeutics, and, of course, Nancy's wonderful books on provings.